a child born really small as a result of environmental stressors that the mother experiences tends to have health outcomes decades later. So this is when they're in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so the
Oh.
field of epigenetics has really started to hone in on this notion of social determinants of health and more interestingly now, environmental determinants of health.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Internet of Nature podcast, a place to explore the emerging technologies and the practitioners that are building greener, healthier, and smarter communities. I'm your host, Nadina Khalla. In this season of the Internet of Nature podcast, we explore the future of urban forestry together with Planet Geo, a pioneering urban forest software and consulting company. I partnered with Planet Geo because they are at the forefront of trees and technology, helping communities around the world map a greener future. Together, we've chosen nine key topics facing the future of urban forestry. In today's episode, episode five, we're diving into how urban forestry can be a powerful tool in promoting positive health and wellness outcomes. This approach is quite new compared to the more traditional ecosystem service model, as it allows cities to focus more on just conservation, but also encourages healthy living habits. I wanted to uncover how can this new approach appeal to those outside of the usual suspects, new stakeholders like general physicians, health departments, educators, and the community at large. To help me unravel urban trees as a public health tool, I've invited Professor Vivek Chandes. Vivek is a professor of climate adaptation at Portland State University and a senior advisor with Kappa Strategies, a global climate consulting firm. Vivek has over two decades of executive experience in the public, university, and private sectors, and he's worked directly with policymakers and community leaders to safeguard cities and natural resources from the disparate and uneven effects of climate change. He has a lot of different expertise, not just in green spaces, but specifically how it intersects with urban heat, air quality, and other markers of human health and well-being. We're going to dive into that and a whole lot more on today's episode. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Vivek. Hi, Vivek. Welcome to the Internet of Nature podcast.
Hi, it's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you on. So before we get into the topic of today's episode, which is all about urban forestry as a public health intervention, can you just give the listeners a little bit of an intro into who you are?
Sure. My name is Vivek Chandes, he, him, his pronouns. I am a professor of climate adaptation at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. And I'm the founder and advisor of Kappa Strategies, a global climate consulting firm.
And how did you get your start into urban forestry and trees?
So I started with urban forestry largely throughout my career, though it really took on a much more serious level of interest when I was in my PhD program at the University of Washington in Seattle, where there was an entire College of Forest Resources, now called the College of the Environment. And my interest was trying to understand the relationship between humans, the way they settle in terms of urban areas, set human settlements, and then how trees factor into those settlements, whether they're completely left out, whether they're brought in, why they're brought in, what was the cultural connection to trees, what was the physical understanding of the role that trees played for human health and well-being. Did they protect us? Did they harm us? And so those were some of the big questions I was asking when I was going through what was called an urban ecology program. And this was in the turn of the last century, just as the 1990s were turning into the 2000s, and we
You make it
were
sound
getting
so long ago.
it feels like a long time ago, but it was literally the turn of the century, a lot of excitement. And the UN was telling us that by 2007, we're going to have 50% of humans living in cities. And so cities and forests became kind of the two pillars around which much of my research were focused. And with cities, the focus is on humans, and with forests, obviously, the trees. And so that's really where I started getting much more into the analytical, the kind of conceptual, and a much more kind of systematic framing of how humans and trees start to, or have been interacting and are now in the urban century becoming either more close or farther apart. And that's what I was really interested in digging into.
And you had a little bit of experience before diving into this topic from an academic standpoint, because if I remember correctly from our previous conversations, you also taught what's known as outdoors school for a while, which is, I believe, is a grade 6 program for Oregon students that they get out there for a week-long outdoors school type course that gets kids from all walks of life and backgrounds out into the great outdoors, specifically kids that might not have had access to otherwise.
Right. Great memory. It's exactly what got me here back to Portland as well. So part of the reason I'm here is because after I finished my undergraduate training, I was looking for jobs frantically all over the country, willing to work on farms, wanting to be with nature. I had a degree in ecology. So part of what I was interested in is going from my kind of Northern California experience to finding a completely different ecosystem. So I moved up to the Pacific Northwest, where I was teaching 6th grade kids. And it was one of the most magical moments of my life, hardest work I've ever done in my life, because it was a residential camp. You have what we call resource instructors, which is what I was, coming to a camp and getting about 50 to 70 sixth graders showing up, spending 4 nights, 5 days, in a completely forested setting where we had rivers and deciduous forests, coniferous forests, open plains. And we would take the sixth graders in small groups to these different habitats and these different biomes, essentially, in this small space. And part of where my early kind of love for teaching, engagement, and outreach really took place was with the sixth graders, because their fascination at sixth grade has been arguably a little bit dulled and kind of many ways systematically oppressed by the other things that their families, that their schools are having them focus on. That then what my job and our collective job as resource instructors and teachers in the outdoor school is to kind of open that up again, resurface their curiosity about nature, about trees, and about the forests in general. And that was really where I found my voice. I feel like that's where things started to make a lot more sense, recognizing that the ways in which we organize are many cases cities where these kids come from. They tend to have people focus on the cars, focus on kind of the houses, the video games, the things that really are not necessarily centering the ecosystems on which we depend, and much more on these kind of structures of what I call hyper-capitalism that have really indoctrinated even by 11, 12, 13-year-old kids, like they already are deep in it. So we're trying to get a lot more understanding about what it takes for kids to be connected to nature, what that connection looks like, what it means for them in their future, and whether, frankly, they can make this a central part of their ethic as they progress and as they get older.
It, when I heard about that program, I was like, well, Oregon, of course, Oregon would have a program like that. But I also just, it's such a beautiful thing. I wish that we could just make that federal wide, nationwide, international. I mean, it's such a, you know, because you have a son who's 12 now.
He just turned 13 in February.
13? Oh, congratulations. So that's, yeah. But you know that age group very well, now having experienced it personally with your own son. So it's this incredible, I feel like, super malleable age where if you know, it's before they turn into real teenagers and they get too jaded, or they, I don't know, they've become disillusioned with the natural world, or they don't want to be a part of it. It's still like such a beautiful, malleable age where if you can introduce them to those things, it can really have a lifelong impact.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember him when he was just, you know, 8 months old, 9 months old, starting to walk, starting to make sense of the world. And he was able to like grab my finger and start to feel like he could have some agency in the actions that he was having in this world. And it was such a beautiful time because as he was entering like one and a half, two, and even up till about maybe seven or eight, there was a real genuine curiosity that I was just constantly overwhelmed and amazed with, because everywhere we would go, whether it was even in our little, patch of a concrete sidewalk in front of our home, he would find the ants and he would look at the ants and he'd watch how they moved along the cracks in the concrete. He would see a spider, he would watch the spider move so gracefully across its net, across its web. And part of that was for me, how do we continue to kind of cultivate, foster, and encourage that curiosity? Because fundamentally, I mean, nature is one of, in my experience, one of the best teachers we could imagine.
No, that's beautiful. And I've had the opportunity to interview you for stuff I've been doing for the book, all about children's connection to nature and what you've experienced in your own life and how you've been applying that with your own son, and also how you've used technology to kind of foster that as well, which always gets people riled up because they don't like to see children, nature, and technology in the same sentence. So we could go off on a big tangent there, but for the purposes of today's topic, I wanted to dive into urban forests as a public health intervention. But maybe let's start with kids. Why are urban forests and urban trees such an important part of urban life for children specifically?
Sure. Yeah, I've spent a good part of the last decades thinking about cities, and the majority of humans now live in cities. The majority of kids now live in cities. And part of what we've done with cities over the last about, I'd say, 100 years, and accelerating definitely in many parts of the world at different times over the last 100 years. Right now, we're seeing huge boom in cities in Asia. That boom's continuing in parts of the Middle East. It was the boom in the early 1900s in Europe, and now Asia, Latin America, Africa, huge amounts of urbanization. What we're doing with our cities these days is largely sealing up the earth. So we're really sealing up the spaces where trees, grass, shrubs can grow in general. And that's largely because the automobile is the central organizing unit for cities. And they have been, cars have been for in the US since the 1940s and 50s. And we're seeing that phenomenon play out in other parts of the world. And one of the things that just breaks my heart is when I travel to India to see my family, who lives about 8 degrees above the equator, and the emergence of cars. And the kids there, and my many cousins and their kids, are similarly very oriented towards cars. And I see that as a way for them to kind of arrive, and the fact that they are showing their success, their social place, through this possession of a car. And the trouble is that that often seals up the physical space for trees. And so this world of planning and kind of urban design and areas that I've been spending a lot of time is really where we need to start thinking about the role that nature, trees, green space generally play. And so when we're talking about a car, it often requires a road, which often requires a lot of space. We're talking about parking the car, which requires parking lots, which seal up space. And this is what kids see. This is the large part of the kind of the experience of many urban children, regardless of where they're growing up these days in cities. And so part of the concern I have is that as we go about in this urbanization process, in this hyper-urbanization in some regions of the world, that we're really losing that ability to go and be close to the things like trees and like ecosystems from which our species has been deeply connected. In fact, I've made arguments in some writing where I've essentially said that part of the reason we're seeing a rapid acceleration of many of the illnesses, whether they be mental health and or physical, even spiritual illnesses that some people claim are deep part of their kind of challenge, their physical, mental, spiritual challenge, is because the kind of removal from those ecosystems and that lack of connection to nature has been something that has caused a great deal of unknown kind of in many ways, unknown but measurable impacts on their health and well-being. And so as children, often I think when we don't spend time outside, there's a lot of literature on the amount of time, the reduction of time children have spent outside in the last few decades. That gets us to really thinking about how does that affect our health and well-being? And now the studies are really starting to become much more palpable, clear, and kind of consistent in that the public health's impact of being detached and removed and away from ecosystems, nature, trees, forests, have a cumulative effect on our health over time that starts to really kind of creates wear and tear on our system. And we can get into that in more detail as helpful. But with children, it's one of the earliest moments where the familiarity of ecosystems is the thing that I focus on. A lot of kids I've worked with taking them from the city to the woods, they're very scared of going into the woods. They're really scared of trees and forests. And that's a real genuine response to or adaptation with not growing up around trees or forests. And so what I try to do and what I love more than anything else is to bring folks who are unfamiliar with forests and trees into a space that actually allows them to see that these are actually things that will benefit us and can help us in our health and well-being over the long term.
No, absolutely. And I want to touch upon something that you said, which is this idea of spiritual illnesses or spiritual disease, because I think we'll get into that a little bit later, the effect that urban forests and trees can have on things like air pollution and air quality and these kinds of really important markers for serious diseases like heart disease and respiratory illnesses that we can face in cities. But it's something that's much, much deeper than that. So if we dive into this mental health component, or even deeper than mental health, this spiritual component, what does that mean? What does it mean for a society at large to have lost its connection to the natural world?
Yeah, it's a huge question. It's something I actually am spending more and more time thinking about and feeling my way through, frankly. I've been trained in a very analytical Western lens approach, and I've been gaining so much insight from my travels to South America and Asia specifically to understand how indigenous communities have been integrating, have been deeply kind of connecting to trees and forests. And whether it's the Shipibo people in Peru who I've spent some time with, or whether it's folks in the Western Ghats of South Asia who have indigenous communities that I've spent time with, part of what I'm recognizing is that the codependence, interdependence, interrelationship that humans have had with nature have been very, very well, kind of articulated and established in rituals that indigenous communities have done as part of their ability to connect to deeper forces that are often at play. So whether it be as simple as seasonality, you know, we hear a lot about eating foods that are seasonal, buying local. These are actually ideas that are indigenous in nature. They are about how do we link to the kind of the seasonality, the trends, and the movements of the forests and the ecosystems around where we live. And when I kind of think about the spiritual illness that many folks experience, is really has a lot to do with that kind of removal of those cycles and those systems that have, for time immemorial, given us strength, given us fortitude, given us our ability to wake up in the morning and actually do an interview, right? And participate in the kinds of things that we really feel are important for the world and for our communities. And so with that spiritual illness, I feel like the ability for us to actually get up and stand up and actually be present is much more difficult when we are away, detached, in somehow removed from those natural cycles and those trees and forests. So for me, if I spend a few weekends not getting out into the woods, spending time even in a small patch of woods, I can certainly feel it on my ability to kind of get up in the morning, to be present, to be really engaging in conversations. So that's what, for me, spiritual illness really feels like and looks like, is the challenge of participating in this moment of time that we have a physical presence on this planet.
No, absolutely. I can definitely relate. And I feel like I've gotten to the point where I can recognize it as such, be like, I can ask myself, when was the last time that you were out for a hike, that you were out, that you were walking around, that you were really connected to nature, that you were grounding yourself. So I can ask myself those questions, realize, oh, yikes. Yeah, that was too long ago. No wonder that I'm feeling this way. But I think for so many people, it's something that they don't even realize that they've lost. And you know, we try to cover it up, you know, with other reasons for it. And of course there can be other things at play, but you try to cover it up with other reasons, like, well, it must be a general anxiety that I have, or it must be, you know, it must be a depression that's just caused by a chemical imbalance in my brain. And that's the reason why I feel like this. And there's such a lack of connection that people don't even realize that that is what it is that they're missing. So when it comes to the environments that the vast majority of human beings live in this day and age, which is of course the city, I'm wondering, in order to foster and facilitate that connection to nature more, do we have to reach people on a spiritual level, help them open their eyes to it? Or do we go in from an almost more an analytical city planning perspective, say, okay, you know, every person that lives in this city needs access to at least X amount of green space, X amount of nature, kind of like, if you build it, they will come kind of approach. What approach should we be taking?
Yeah, you know, humans have been asking this question, I think, probably for time immemorial. It's like, do we find our connection to this planet we live on through the physical planning that we do and the information that we have access to? And there are communities that have created ritualized practices of going deep into the woods and going deep into often unsullied by the human hand. Places where this kind of reverence and reconnection to, excuse me, Earth and its specific cycles and processes are immediately present. I am not one to be able to say to any individual that, you know, the spiritual path is the one for you. I want each person to find what resonates with them and what moves them and kind of they find their path. For me, I can simply say that it's a both and response, that we really do need to be thinking about how to kind of liberate the earth in our cities. And at the same time, how do we find those kind of rituals that will allow us to almost transition momentarily even into a state where we're absolutely present with our immediate surroundings? Like if I can sit here and talk with you, listen to your questions and be immediately present, that is a major benefit to the listeners and to the folks who you're going to be engaging with. If I'm kind of detached and in somewhere else and not able to actually be present here, then it's going to be so much harder for me to connect with you, connect with the communities that might be listening to this work. So for me, that idea of presence and simply the fact that I spent the last weekend out in the woods allows me to be here with you a lot more. So I can't say whether, you know, let's do this analytically, let's do this through a path that allows everybody a spiritual opportunity. I can't necessarily say that from my professional point of view. I would say that the approach I tend to use is one that's accepted by a lot of the decision makers. And we're in a, you know, secular society here in the United States where I live. And a big part of that is, how do we use science? How do we use kind of a health, how do we use measures of health and well-being to be able to advance a design of the physical places we live that will improve or at best maintain our health and well, or at minimum maintain our health and well-being. And so we use that analytical, rational, very much more what I would call kind of a Western European lens to be able to think about settlements in the way that we do this. There are a lot of communities outside of Western Europe that have been set, that have settlements that are deeply connected to spiritual rituals and practices that have also been around, as I was saying earlier. But in the context I'm in, this is the kind of analytical approach that seems the most palpable for a lot of the decision makers that I'm working with these days.
No, absolutely. So maybe on that note, apart from the spiritual side of things and the spiritual reasons, I think that can be very, very powerful for expressing a deeper than human need for and desire for more nature and air and spaces close to where we live. Let's speak the language of the decision makers for a moment here and get into some of the most convincing health and well-being indicators that you've been able to use in your work. So I know heat has been a big one, air quality is a big one, but perhaps there's even examples of using things like rates of obesity, rates of respiratory illnesses. I know for pregnant women, birth weight, their baby's birth weight can be a really interesting marker of how much green space is in their area. So talk to me a little bit about, apart from the spiritual, what are some other markers of health and well-being when it relates to urban forestry?
Sure. And I will say that the two are very interconnected in my world. They tend to really, one tends to kind of deeper questions about our place on this planet and the kind of spiritual questions I tend to ask tie very closely to these much more practical measures of health and well-being that we're about to talk about. So that said, I guess the way I tend to think about it is almost chronological. Chronological by simply the idea that the evidence base that's emerging, and now we have decades of great public health research, epidemiological research, that really tells us a very clear story, again, that Indigenous communities have been telling us for a very, very long time. And that those communities that are away from green spaces in their cities tend to live in much hotter environments. So in the short term, chronologically, in the short term, they tend to live in hotter environments. And so when a heat wave comes through, the shade that's provided by green space, as well as the kind of what we have, through the sunlight and through heat, we get a lot of tropospheric ozone. We get air quality impacts and these kind of photochemical reactions that happen in the atmosphere that some colleagues of mine study very closely. Those are some of the kind of air pollutants that we're really concerned about. And we have that heat. So this atmospheric condition where we're spending a lot of time these days looking at the relationship between these atmospheric conditions and the health and well-being of communities, we're finding that the places where people die tend to have, during heat waves in the short term, tend to have far fewer trees. We're finding that they tend to have the places where trees are also cut down the fastest. So a paper we're about to publish is essentially showing that not only is the absence of trees much lower in the hottest parts of town, we're also showing that rates of loss of trees in those areas, a dynamic process off mediated by urban planning processes, tend to be loss of those trees in already hot places. And that's both by, you know, the developer's acts coming through and by the fact that hotter places, trees tend to suffer quite a bit more. Trees have been helping us for a long time. And so now it really turns out we need to be helping trees as well, because we're noticing scorching of needles. We're noticing loss of entire limbs. Trees will just drop a branch if it's, you know, sudden branch drop, you know, is a thing. And I've been monitoring trees where you slowly start seeing the tree dying from the top down as temperatures get hotter and hotter in that neighborhood over time. And so, yes, health and well-being of humans and human populations, though, yes, also the fact that we're building our cities in such a way that's also harming the trees that we're putting, and often the native and ecologically historical trees and adapted trees for that region are suffering some pretty severe consequences. And so there's that health and atmospheric piece. There's also a piece that comes up around that I like to think about a lot is intergenerational. So this is the longer view. When a community is living next to a place that has had an industrial facility or a big box store or a manufacturing, a commercial land use, a lot of cars are coming in and out of that space. And so there's little bits of pollutants that are generated from a lot of human activity in those locations. And over time, we're learning that families that live next to pollution have intergenerational We'll get into this word a bit, intergenerational trauma, physical and mental trauma, by living adjacent to places that generate lots of pollution. We're finding that, in fact, maternal and child health outcomes of households living adjacent to highly polluted areas or places that have lots of heat, extreme heat during heat waves, and even more generally, when temperatures are really high and we're living in a place without cooling options, that pregnant mothers often experience some pretty severe health outcomes. We're seeing that babies are either born much smaller as a result of that, or they're born much larger. And so it's kind of a U-shaped curve when you plot it out. And what that means is, okay, a baby's born young, no big deal. We can put the baby in a NICU, and bring the baby to full health. What's interesting is that the research in epigenetics is showing that these are long-term consequences. We're finding that a child born really small as a result of environmental stressors that the mother experiences tends to have health outcomes decades later. So this is when they're in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so the field of epigenetics has really started to hone in on this notion of social determinants of health, and more interestingly now, environmental determinants of health, as we're seeing the multiple stressors that if a mother, as a mother feels it, how that actually affects the long-term health of their offspring, their children. And so this is now true in humans. It's been true in other creatures for a long time that humans have known about, but we're starting to get much better evidence of that short-term kind of exposure to heat and air pollutants for as just simple examples, and then intergenerational impacts that we're starting to get better evidence for as well.
Hey, everybody. Thanks again to this season's sponsor, Planet Geo. Planet Geo has a suite of software and services all designed to shift the urban forestry conversation from hypothetical to reality. See the link in the show notes to learn more. And now, back to the show.
It's both terrifying because it feels like something, you know, people live where they live, and a lot of people don't have the resources to just up and move elsewhere, but it also feels like a massive opportunity. And I can imagine, going back to originally what you mentioned about analytics and the importance of data and how your work professionally has been very much focused on that, what kind of tools are you using to be able to identify where those areas are? Because I would, from my perspective, that would be the first step, right? Understanding where these areas are.
Right. No, tools are a big part of this trade, like with most trades. The tools that we need really to begin with, and the reason we're starting to get at these findings much more convincingly these last couple of decades, is because I will just say the resolution of data has just been revolutionary for the work that we're doing. We're not only able to get more data across different sectors, we're also able to get more granular data. And so what I mean by granular or detailed or resolution, it really is about, how do we know what an individual is experiencing? How do we know what the air underneath their nose is? How do we know what the temperature on their skin is? And we're getting studies are coming out now that are actually able to very unequivocally show the exposure that somebody has at their household to pollutants and to heat. And what we've done a great deal is we've gone about using some of these sensors, these very low-cost sensors that you can get off the shelf, very defensible science and very research grade, yet still low cost. And we can get community groups to go out and collect tens of thousands of measurements in one fell swoop across a hot day. And we can put air pollutants like particulate matter, 2.5, 1, 10, and we can gather that information at resolutions that we've never been able to see before. So the moment we first did this, we should say,
Vivek, too, this is Heat Watch. This is the campaign that Kappa Strategies, your organization, is known for.
That's right. So we've actually, Kappa Strategies has been kind of launched as a one of the branches of work, or the flagship program is really called Heat Watch and Air Watch. These are the two things that we're doing where we're essentially connecting with community groups in a place. We've done this now in over 85 places here in the US and Canada, Mexico, as well as in Brazil and Indonesia and Sierra Leone and Doha, Qatar, and so many, many places around the world and the US. And part of it is getting community groups to really look directly at these differences in temperature that we are able to show them, that this neighborhood that you're living in is 20 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than this adjacent neighborhood. And they will look at these maps and just scratch their head and say, wow, that's exactly why I go over to my friend's house, this high school student was telling me, when it's really hot out, because we know that it's cooler at his house than it is mine, even though neither of us have air conditioning units. And so these kinds of stories of kind of lived experience have helped corroborate a lot of the analytical findings with these low-cost sensors and essentially to help tell a story very locally in each of these communities that there were planning practices and design guidelines that were established in places that really kind of marginalized, alienated, and in many cases segregated neighborhoods without trees, without green space. And as a result, that tends to have a kind of a feedback effect where now communities living there are paying more for their energy bills, are experiencing greater rates of impacts on their health and well-being, are experiencing intergenerational trauma, which we can get into, and are in a state where they have, in many ways, very little control over what's happening in and around their neighborhood. So what we want to do is put this evidence in front of them, ask the question of why is this actually happening? And then what can I do about it? And then help with the other programs that CAPA currently runs. Growing capacities is another one where we're able to actually shore up their kind of evidence base and their conceptual and kind of planning expertise to be able to go and advocate for various kinds of green space measurements and green space designs that are brought into those neighborhoods. And so that's been happening all over. I'm kind of getting out of the way of that because it is incredibly inspiring to see communities go out and take control over their own neighborhood, their own city block, and to start talking about what it means to have more greenery here and how do we tear up a little bit of this sidewalk, get a tree well in and get established trees there. How do we bump out curbs? How do we redesign our physical infrastructure that has been, again, monopolized by the car to then allow for green space to become more present in our everyday lives? And so that's been just an overwhelmingly like compelling experience for me to see how just little bits of highly granular data using low-cost sensors, using a pretty systematic process, can get folks really charged and activated to bringing more green space into cities.
Yeah, and I think what always inspires me the most about HeatWatch and AirWatch is that you are providing evidence, you're providing a scientific, a robust backing to people's mm-hmm. lived experiences. So people that live in these neighborhoods, they don't need to be told that it's particularly hot in the summer. They know, they felt it for years. But anecdotal evidence can only get you so far when it comes to really pushing and advocating for that change. And what I love about HeatWatch is that it's about those same citizens, those that have the lived experience, being empowered to then use the tools and create that evidence base for themselves so they can continue that advocacy. So it's not about some other organization coming in and say, you know, we'll make the map for you. It's like, no, you are responsible and you can. Here are the tools to help you create that map. So maybe for the listeners, that are listening and feel like this is something that their community needs, because you mentioned HeatWatch has been to many different places, but there's still many, many more places that need to be mapped. And of course, that need to be mapped multiple times to really get an idea of what the heat and the air quality problem might look like. So just walk the listeners through what the process is like for someone reaching out to CAPA wanting to do a HeatWatch campaign in their own community.
Sure. And I'll quickly say to the listeners also that, you know, getting data may seem like a mundane process in many ways. You set up sensors and things. Turns out over the decades, this is another thing I'm spending a lot of time thinking about and trying to figure out how to write to this idea. that I've, is simply the fact that we have most cities have about less than half a dozen temperature and air quality sensors that are set up. So this is across a vast dozens of square kilometers space. We have a few sensors that are set up that can tell you essentially what's going on in and around that environment. So it turns out we've created an entire system that doesn't give us the information we need in order to take, evidence-based decisions, even though we're in a culture where analytical and evidence-based drives ostensibly the ways in which we're making decisions. So that
it's
was
a really
done
good
in large
point.
I mean, my personal view is that that was done largely in part because there were a lot of in the 1900s, a lot of high polluting industries that didn't want that information to be known and or seen. And so that kind of like
definitely not made public.
Yes, right. Not made public. Similar to what we were hearing about all the climate change conversations and the greenhouse gas conversations that are happening in the 50s that were not made public as well. But nevertheless, we don't have really good detailed data. And the moment we get detailed data, it transforms the way we think about space and how we want to use it. So that's where HeatWatch, AirWatch, and the Growing Capacities Program really takes effect, is that if a community group wanted to reach out, they'd essentially go to our website called kappastrategies.com, and they would reach out to program manager, and we take them through essentially a very systematic step-by-step process where we provide training materials, we provide kind of background readings, and it's not a lot of material. It's enough to be able to whet the appetite, get enough information about why to do this so that individuals, what we call local champions, feel really like they have the level of information about what frankly is a very complex topic about, urban atmospheric conditions, but enough information to be able to take the first step into, let me find out what it really looks like in my city, in my region. And we provide them with the training, the background, and then the equipment, essentially these sensors that we've been continuing to revise year after year. We have a really phenomenal stock of sensors and engineers that have helped us develop these. And we essentially send these out to the community. They mount them on bicycles, on cars, they mount them on backpacks, and they're out at 6 a.m. in the morning, just as the sun's coming up on a hot summer day. And then around 2 to 3 p.m. in the afternoon, and then once again in the evening, 7 to 8 p.m. And they're going out and collecting three periods of 1 hour each, data on heat and air quality. And we are able to then take all of that data that they go out and collect in those three periods and create these surfaces. Basically, a surface is a map that describes at 10 meter resolution the temperature of a particular household or a particular location at morning, afternoon, and evening. So we get what we call a diurnal profile of the entire temperature of that day and of the air pollutants that are affecting that place that day as well. So it turns out that it's not rocket science. It requires some pretty sophisticated mapping processes, which we published on. It's allows us to really get integrate satellite data with this ground level measurements, and then we put those two together and generate these maps that then turn out to make their way into climate adaptation plans, climate action plans, disaster management plans, etc. And so it's been a pretty carefully constructed and kind of developed process over the years, because we made a lot of mistakes early on with working with community groups. These are often, locally, they're driven by passion, they're driven by curiosity, and they're out collecting lots of really interesting data that we're able to essentially give right back to them in much greater resolution.
And just to clarify, the different volunteers, they're walking the same route all three times.
Right.
So
right.
There's
we
different
do that.
Routes that have been predetermined.
That's right. That's right. Thank you for that clarification. Yeah, they do that so that we know that this road or this particular park, the temperature in the morning is, let's say 75 degrees Fahrenheit, temperature in the afternoon goes up to 105 degrees Fahrenheit, and then it drops down to 80 degrees Fahrenheit or 90 degrees Fahrenheit in the evening. So we're able to actually see one location change over time. And those are predetermined routes. And it really helps us then to take, I mean, we get often almost 100,000 measurements compared to three or four measurements, regularly. And that 100,000, there are analytical and algorithmic processes that we use that just are data hungry, and they can really churn through all of that and help to develop descriptions.
Absolutely. And what if you had to, give an example of one of the most inspiring stories that you've come across in the years of working on heat and air watch of a citizen or a community group that's used this data to advocate for change and more greenery, what would an example story be?
Oh, it's such a hard question. There's so many stories. Maybe could I do two really short?
We'll allow it, Vivek.
Okay. Well, there's just two quick ones. One was just there was a student who had left high school, wasn't interested in high school, and it wasn't working for them. And
oh, I know this one. I love this one.
Yeah, this is the one I tend to go back to. There's another one I love that I think you may have talked
no,
about.
No, but tell this one. It's amazing.
Yeah. This one is like, they did not, high school wasn't working for them. They're like, go and take that. What we can do is a general education exam. It's a GED exam, diploma that they can get for high school. So they were going to take that. And they happened to participate in a program that was engaged in this heat watch. And they weren't interested in science, didn't really care about climate or any of those issues. And it was really interesting to meet them when they first came in and were doing our training in person. Back in 2017, and they were pretty, like, sitting in the back of the room. Like, I've taught a lot of classes. I can kind of identify people early on, like, oh, you're not interested in this topic, are you? So let me try to see what we can do to kind of inspire a little bit. So we got these sensors. We talked about them. They were kind of standing in the back, not really interested, kind of meandering away from the crowd, really, or the group of people. And then after that, we went out and collected the temperatures, and this was exactly the moment of transition. We went out, told them, they did their route, everything. They rode their bike, collected all this data, and then came back, and we then showed these maps, and we started asking people where their homes were. And this is the story I was saying earlier, is that this person was saying that their house was 20 degrees warmer than their friend's house. And as a result of that, they started asking the question of, why is my house so much warmer? I don't get it. I didn't do anything to my house to make it warmer. I didn't change it. And so that's when they got really provoked, I think is the probably easiest way to put it. They started looking around, and it could almost tell that some spark had been ignited. And that was when they started asking what was going on. They ended up, as I heard later, digging into that a bit more, going into college at local University of Richmond, getting a degree in environmental science, as I heard recently, going on to study climate change and urban areas, and the kind of solutions that can be potentially created for reducing temperatures in urban areas. So that story for me was just really encapsulated, like, the individual experience of, like, why does this even matter, to, wow, this is something that actually affects me in my day-to-day life. What I like to call the climate of everyday life, like this notion that we are constantly engaging in a transforming climate system that impacts not just the polar bears in, distant parts of the world, but also our backyards and our own personal health and well-being. And so that was a moment of transformation I'd love to touch on. And really quick, the other story is just a group of students, high school students, who lived in what we call in the U.S. the projects in Yonkers, New York, and they went out, and we gave them these tiny little sensors. And these sensors are great because they have little tiny.
Maybe just cameras. Explain it for the listeners, Vivek. What are you holding?
I'm holding a FLIR. It's a technology that actually comes from, like, the internet, the defense world, and it's for seeing the world like a panther would see it, in infrared. So it's able to clip into a smartphone. And it turns your camera into essentially the eyes of a big cat. Like, you can see where heat is, you can see where cool is, And it will give you all of that kind of information. We had the high school students go out and take pictures of the hottest places and the coolest places. And we cast that around a zombie exercise where there were zombies coming into Yonkers and they had to go find the warmest places, because we all know that zombies don't like warm places.
Of course.
And so they went out and they found the places in their neighborhood that were their backyards, often parking lots, that were some of the hottest places. And they said, you know, here's where the zombie would go. Here's the coolest places. Here's the warmest place. Here's where I would go. And they put these kind of images together, talked about the differences in the temperatures, and then use that exercise to go to city council and advocate for more green spaces in their neighborhoods, and how shade and shade inequities have been systematically created through planning processes. And their neighborhood was one of their neighborhoods where the city was essentially saying, oh, you live in a low-income neighborhood, you don't need trees, you need housing. And so the kind of pitting of housing against trees has been an ongoing challenge for conversations I've been having. And the high school students were immediately able to see it through a tiny little camera exercise that actually went all the way to city council and got city council to put in tens of millions of dollars in green space and planning within the neighborhoods that some of the kids were talking about. So those are two quick stories just to kind of case out the stories about planners and going in and getting resources to be able to green up neighborhoods. There's dozens and dozens of those, but these stories of like individuals who are kind of distant from the topic that get brought in through these activities has been an ongoing theme for my educational interests. And that's why I kind of hone in on things like that.
No, it's beautiful. And I love that they both center around high school students as well, as per throwing it back all the way to the beginning of the conversation, that just because you didn't grow up an environment necessarily filled with a lot of green space or trees doesn't exclude you from getting involved later. And really, with this data in hand, being able to drive real change. I mean, I can't imagine anything more rewarding.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, there are glimmers here and there, but now I'm also doing a lot more of the administrative kind of, you know, I'm away from the front, like training, and there's others doing that. And I really do miss that. And I'm hoping to get back into that at someday.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for anyone listening, what is the best place to both connect with you and with Kappa Strategies online?
Well, with me, I'm university, probably the easiest way, vshondas@pdx.edu. That's my email. And Kappa is just kappastrategies.com. And we tried to keep the website up to date. We really are so focused on the work that the website gets updated only maybe once or twice a year. But we do try to post all the things that we've been doing on that site as frequently as we can. But again, the work takes precedent over the actual visibility of some of the work. We've got, fortunately, this kind of work gets a lot of visibility. So you can find like newspaper, like news documentaries. There's some great ones out of Europe recently that came out on this work. There's many, many local stories that are bubbling up here as well. But yeah, those are organizations that I'm continuing to support, and we'll look forward to kind of learning from your listeners, like how can we do this work even more effectively for communities maybe that where we haven't worked or like to continue working.
And on that note, so for any listener that wants to get involved and maybe organize their own Heat Watch or Air Watch campaign in their own community, going to kappastrategies.com, and then there's a contact form that they can get in touch with the program manager.
Yeah, that's okay. Exactly right. Program manager, I'll get back to you. It's been really, we can only do so many. We don't have inexhaustible amounts of sensors or equipment. We can only do so many. So when program manager gets, if you reach out early, it tends to help a lot, because then we can kind of schedule it in. And it often is seasonal, though we're finding that a lot more people want to find out what the differences in temperature are between summer. I mean, in areas that have a lot of seasonality, summer, fall, winter, and spring. And it really ties back into that indigenous knowledge about how our places are changing seasonally. And while Kappa was started around these extremes, where I'm starting to go is thinking about it like, how does this entire neighborhood and this individual residence, how does it change in more in the morning, afternoon, and evening throughout the entire year. And that information can really help us better identify the kinds of green space, the kind of tree species, all that kind of work that can happen with greater resolution of data.
Interesting. Yeah, well, plenty of more work to be done, that's for sure. That's for sure. Okay, Vivek, I will leave you with the last question that I ask all of my guests who come on the show, and that is, what does the Internet of Nature mean to you?
The Internet of Nature is the OG Internet. It's the original Internet that we know of. I see the things that trees are doing, such as connecting with each other. I mean, many of the words that come up when I think about trees are kind of things like rooting and consolidating and gathering and collecting and steeping and nourishing and regrowth. Like, the Internet of Nature is all those things that help ecosystems better communicate with one another, stay better informed, and really look out for each other when there's any harmful pests or pathogens or other kinds of things that could hurt us, and informing each other and supporting each other and helping to regrow from some of those traumatic experiences. And so the Internet of Nature is really the original Internet, and one that helps us better connect with each other like we're doing today, and like I hope we continue to do as this field grows and blossoms and we get a much better understanding of how we can support each other in this process of regrowing our cities with green spaces in mind.
Absolutely. Well, cheers to that. Here's hoping to that. That sounds like a future that I want to be a part of. That's for sure.
Absolutely. Me too. That's what we're all That's waking up in the morning every day. That's the hope, is how do we make the places we live a little bit more convivial, a little bit more thriving, and allows us to really be in touch with the planet on which we depend.
That's what it's all about. Well, thank you, Vivek, for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Thank you for listening to the Internet of Nature podcast. Want to learn more about the Internet of Nature? Subscribe to my newsletter at nadinechala.com. I'm looking forward to bringing you another great guest next week. As always, remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review if you learned something new. The best way to support us is to share this episode with a friend or colleague. Season 5 of the Internet of Nature podcast on the future of urban forestry is brought to you by Planet Geo. See you next week.